Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Fill her up.
You're listening to the Gas Digital Network.
Welcome to another episode of Without a Country. I am Corinne Fisher, your host. You know me. You feel okay about me. Some of you hate watch. That's fun. That's exciting. Oh, my jacket's in the background. What a sherbet of colors. Okay, welcome, welcome, welcome. It is Tuesday, April 25th when we're recording this. Lots on the docket today. We have Mike Harrington in the booth as always, and we have a return of Natalie just for this week, but this is very exciting to have her back in the booth, a fellow woman. That's nice. A rarity here at the Gas Digital Studios. How you been, Natalie?
I'm good. I'm just the day person now.
Don't sell yourself short like that. You're the day person.
I'm the day person.
You're
now.
The day person. That
my
sounds
shift
good.
Doesn't extend to Without a Country, unfortunately.
That sounds good. I mean, not for us, but it sounds good in general. I am the day person. Well, I'm glad that you have your nightlife back. Have you been filling it with drug-induced raves? Or
no, unfortunately not. Okay. I miss the show very much, but I don't miss staying here until 9 o'clock every
yeah
week.
You know what, who does really, who does? What, how old are you these days, Natalie?
I'm 25.
How does that feeling for you?
Good. I'm gonna be 26 next month.
Okay. And what a 25 year old thing to say.
Yeah.
No one in there.
By next month I mean it's in a couple weeks.
It's in a couple. It's a May birthday?
Yeah.
Okay. What's your sign? Taurus?
Taurus, yeah, the 15th.
Okay. All right. Nice.
Me and Mike too, right? Oh. Yeah, the whole booth is Taurus.
Oh, it's a Taurus energy in the booth. I like a Taurus energy.
Yeah, me too.
I think that's good. I think that's good. That's exciting. I'm a Libra, so.
Mm-hmm. That's air?
It's balanced, you know. Is it an air sign? Yeah, I guess so. I don't know. I only half believe in astrology.
Me too.
But when times, you know, when desperate times call for desperate measures, so you need to look into astrology. I only half believe in a lot of things, which honestly, very Libra of me. Okay. All right. So let's get to some stories. I'm too busy looking at the one side of my face that has brutal light on it. So will be unusable. Let's see. Okay. So enemy of the state this week, we're going to get right into the show. We're going to get right into it. It's Lady Gaga. It's Lady
enemy
Gaga
of the state.
And I know that's a weird pull. Okay, so this is a little bit more in the Two Less Lonely Girls podcast vein than it is Without a Country. But I did come across it on social media. So there's this account I follow, like Entertainment Lawyer, and it's a very popular like Hollywood It's not conspiracy theory, really. They do some conspiracy theories, but it's mostly like blind items is what they call them. So they'll kind of describe an actor or a singer to a T, and you'll be able to figure out like who it is, and they'll reveal these crazy Hollywood secrets. But you have to be very into the entertainment business to probably be reading this stuff. So it never goes like super, super wide. And obviously the people that they're talking about often have a lot of money and power, so they can get these things hidden. Because I mean, like, these blind items are a lot of times about people, you know, on the level of like Beyonce. So this one is, you know, they've been revealing this month on that Instagram a lot of blind items. And I came across one for Lady Gaga that was particularly interesting, basically saying that the conspiracy theory is that she either murdered or had, you know, higher murdered this other singer many years ago, Lena Morgana, and this enabled her to skyrocket to the level of fame that she ultimately reached. And this kind of resurfaced because last summer, a fashion designer named Katie Gallagher also died via homicide, and the conditions under which she died are very suspicious, but she also dressed Lady Gaga and seemed to have kind of been involved in that circle. So it is, you know, to borrow from Mike's conspiracy theories, very Clinton-esque of Lady Gaga. And this is interesting because I am familiar with many, many celebrity conspiracy theories, you know, including lizard, you know, that fucking Justin Bieber is like a lizard, you know, those kind of things. But this is one that I was not familiar with. And I'm a pretty big Lady Gaga fan, so I was interested to see. Of course, when you Google it, it's hard to get anything concrete because these people have access to so much money that they are able to get the internet wiped of these things, because that's certainly possible when you're at that level. But I did find a Forbes article from 2010 that kind of dips into it a little bit, because after that, you're going to really not reputable sites like, you know, yourtango.com, which is like where I go when I need to like have a tarot card explained. So again, like, I wouldn't trust it for real news. But this is from September 9th, 2010, and it says Lena Morgana haunts Lady Gaga. In more people stealing credit from Lady Gaga news, so already slanted towards Lady Gaga, Yana Morgana claims that her now deceased daughter, Lena Morgana, shaped Gaga into the superstar she is today. She is seeking rights to release songs the pair recorded before 19-year-old Lena committed suicide. Lena's ex-manager says Gaga did write some of the musician's songs, and they recorded 12 more together that were not released. And that I have confirmed from other sources as well, that they were basically working as a writing and singing duo. Morgana accuses Gaga of stealing her daughter's fashion style, performance techniques, and dramatic stagecraft, according to NewYorkPost.com. If you click on that New York Post thing, that's long gone. That link is long dead. Lena Morgana. She also told the paper that Gaga assumed her daughter's dark side, saying Gaga talks about having a dark and tragic life, but she had everything she wanted in the world. She went to the same high school as Nikki Hilton. Her parents were rich, but Lena did have a tough life. Gaga hit the national stage a month after Lena died. I mean, now listen, you know, saying that you had a hard life when you didn't, I don't know that anyone owns that story conceptually. That's a bit of a reach. But, you know, it is certainly arguable that Lady Gaga has a very, very specific performance style. And I myself have often wondered, it's like, where did this come from? I kind of always just figured she was like a Lydia Deetz type girl, just like a weird girl in regular surroundings who kind of let her imagination run wild. Because there's a little bit of that in me for sure. Like, I'm not rich, but I come from like a very regular suburban New Jersey background. So a lot of the weirdness I have or performative nature that I have is kind of just stuff that I made up in my room alone, you know? All right, so Forbes says, I've reached out to Lady Gaga's publicist for comment. Forbes estimates the pop sensation earned $62 million from June 2009 to June 2010. And it's not the first time others have tried to cut in on her success. Ex-boyfriend and producer Rob Fusari sued the artist earlier this year for $30 million, saying he discovered her. She countersued in March. Also, I didn't know that you get fucking, didn't know that you get like a rate for discovering someone. Because then I'm going to claim that I discovered several people. I mean, go look at my student films. The Morgana accusation comes from after a recent Vogue cover of Lady Gaga covered in raw meat. Remember that? That was my favorite Lady Gaga. As gimmicky as she may be, you just have to give her credit for constant headline making. So number one, what I love about this Forbes article is number one, I don't even know why this is in Forbes because this is, I mean, I guess because it's they're talking about lawsuits and financial stuff briefly. But this, the woman who wrote the article on the Forbes staff is obviously like a huge, like a little monster. And if you, for those not familiar, that's what Lady Gaga calls her fans. And it's just so funny to write an article with this much obvious bias towards the artist who is being accused of the thing. That's a little bit wild to me that Forbes let this go. So I found that piece. And then, and again, there was very limited stuff to go to. I'm sure I could do a little more deep digging and find like conspiracy theory podcasts. That's probably and TikToks, but those are hard, and I don't really like to introduce them a ton on this show because again, this is like supposed to be a more newsworthy show. Whereas Two Less Lonely Girls, we could just do whatever the fuck we wanted because you know it was more fun. This is from Women's Wear Daily, which very reputable for fashion news, which is why I picked it from here. Designer Katie Gallagher's death is deemed a homicide, and this is actually from March 24th of this year. The designer's family is advising anyone with information to contact the New York Police Department. The death of the independent New York-based designer, Catherine Katie Gallagher, has been ruled a homicide. And the reason I also researched this is because in the blind item from the Entertainment Lawyer podcast slash Instagram, and that I will say is a little more reputable because it is a licensed lawyer doing it. So there is some standards that he or she has to live up to. The actual handle is NT Lawyer, if anyone wants to follow. But these were all combined together in the same blind item. No arrests have been made, and the investigation remains ongoing, according to officials at the New York Police Department. The New York City Chief Medical Examiner's Office determined that the cause was due to acute intoxication by the combined effects of fentanyl, p-fluorofentanyl and ethanol. The 35-year-old had been found on July 24th in her Lower East Side apartment on Eldridge Street. Shortly before 9 p.m. on July 24th, NYPD responded to a 911 call and found the designer unconscious and unresponsive on a bed in a bedroom. On a bed in a bedroom, according to the police report that was filed last summer. There were no signs of trauma. EMS responded and pronounced Gallagher deceased. Asked if Gallagher's death was being investigated as a drug-facilitated theft, as had been reported by one news outlet Friday, an NYPD spokesperson said the investigation remains ongoing. Gallagher's sister, Laura, said via email, if people have info, they should contact the NYPD. In a statement issued Friday, the Gallagher family said they have been proactively working with the NYPD, NYC Office of Chief Medical Examiner, and Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg for the past 8 months to get answers about Katie's sudden death. We realize that the news released today, while difficult, is a necessary step towards seeking justice for Katie, which is our primary goal. Her relatives acknowledged how the homicide determination affirms what we knew. Katie was the victim of a crime. We have been holding this information while awaiting the official ruling. Sharing this news helps us set the record straight, demand accountability, and grieve more openly. The statement continued, we are grateful for any developments that help us move forward, focus on Katie's life and legacy, and bring up more awareness to fentanyl and similar drugs being used as weapons against innocent people, and sometimes people using it against themselves. And then it goes into her where she studied and her celebration of life a little bit, and there's a GoFundMe page. While Gallagher never ascended to international stardom or national fame, she created her own storyline and maintained a certain ingenuity. There were also occasional sparks of personal triumph, such as suiting up Lady Gaga, Laverne Cox, and Daphne Guinness on occasion. Following her death, Prabal Gurung's chief operating officer, Shan Reddy, who met Gallagher during her interning days, says she's the story of so many New Yorkers that come to the city with nothing and give it everything, making it the place the world looks to for creativity, inspiration, and most importantly, grit. And then they talk more about her. But I just found that I just want to kind of like look into that more because it's you know I love a dramatic conspiracy theory. And listen, if you go to this anti-lawyer Instagram page, there are so many. There anyone you want to find a conspiracy theory about that is an A plus A minus Hollywood celeb, you can find it. But like, I don't know. Some of them are so far fetched too. Like there was one about Beyonce and Jay-Z, how they're like basically like harvesting fetuses or something. I mean, I'm not saying this word for word, but there's some wild shit on there. And it really does make you think, because it's like, I think if, you know, 10 years ago you had said that there was like a private island with, you know, young girls that pedophiles in the entertainment business went to visit to fuck, everyone would be like, what are you talking about? Like, but those things really do exist. And I think as we go further and further into the future from the present, we will find just how terrible human beings really are, which is exciting. Buckle up, everybody. So yeah, I just wanted to give you guys a little taste of Two Less Lonely Girls this week and our enemy of the state. Moving forward, checking in with an old friend of ours. That's right, you guys. It is Casey Anthony. And when we talk about people that I would absolutely love to have on the show, I mean, not going to do it for free, obviously, but Casey Anthony, I mean, that would be interview of a fucking lifetime. Maybe if I tell Casey that I'm a big fan of hers, maybe that'll be what she needs to come on Without a Country. Mike, why are you looking weird at me?
Because I'm just shocked at the idea of, you know, she wouldn't do it for free. I mean, a Zoomer says it'll leave her house?
Yeah, but the thing is, like, she had been silent for years until she was offered whatever the undisclosed amount of money was for the documentary series that she did. I don't think she's... the one thing about Casey Anthony, I don't think she's stupid. I don't think she's stupid. And I think when you talk more than you should, that is the sign of someone who is unintelligent. One of the keys to succeeding... I mean, and it's unfortunate that I chose a profession of talking. So I guess that's just point, you know, I'm with stupid. It's me. But yeah, to talk the least amount possible, I think that's why Victoria Beckham is the most successful Spice Girl by a landslide. That bitch wasn't talking in interviews. Beyonce, she never gives interviews anymore. It's a genius move. All right, so this is from TMZ. Again, that was basically the most reputable source that I could pull from for this story. Mike did find it on Twitter, and then I went and kind of Googled to get a little bit more meat on the bones on this. Casey Anthony hanging out.
Speaking of meat on the bones.
She has a big ass. That's what Mike is talking about. Casey Anthony hanging out in the there's yet another reason why I should fucking play her. Casey Anthony hanging out in the kids' toy section at Disney World sure is a strange sight to see. But that's exactly what you got here as she continues her trip at the House of Mouse. The formerly acquitted defendant, who was on trial in Florida over a decade ago for the murder of her daughter, was spotted again Friday at the happiest place on earth, only this time she seemed interested in the plush doll options that the Mouse House had to offer. We're told these photos were taken inside one of the general merchandise stores within downtown Disney Springs, and as you can see, she's perusing and browsing the toys. Granted, just about everything inside this store is child-friendly, but still, it's a little jarring considering her history with her own late daughter, Kaylee, who was found dead in 2008 not far from here, which became the center of a massively publicized trial against her mom. Like we said, Casey was found not guilty of any of the serious charges pertaining to Kaylee's death. She was only found guilty of lying to the police at the time and got off on everything else. And yet she still has that stench hovering around her, just like OJ. Anywho, Casey ventured elsewhere at Disney World this weekend, including to the Epcot Center, where eyewitnesses saw her in the Japan area. Epcot breaks up its sections into worldly corners, and this photo of Casey suggests she knew people recognized her. I mean, I'm sure her whole life she knows people recognize her. I'm actually, like, wildly surprised she hasn't, like, bleached her hair or done something to change how she looks. She really looks exactly the same. As we reported, Casey appears to be there with at least two other women who are tagging along, and there's been no indication she's trying to maintain a low profile whatsoever. Of course, that's her prerogative, but she's also got to realize people are probably going to do double takes if they notice her, and Disney goers undoubtedly have. Nevertheless, California seems to be, Casey Anthony. I don't know why they did it like California. Nevertheless, Casey Anthony seems to be relatively unbothered and is carrying on with her business like nothing happened. But the thing is, it's like, well, if she didn't murder her daughter, nothing did happen, guys. Like, I mean, this is the problem. I mean, the problem is mostly for people who were, you know, falsely accused, which we've talked about it at length. I don't know the situation with Casey Anthony. There's definitely some weird foul play there, but it's like, you know, when you have the public, when you are so recognizable by the public, like, you can never truly be exonerated. And that's not fair to people who, like, didn't commit the crime. So, I mean, that's like in the case of like Damien Echols in the West Memphis 3. Like, I would bet a lot of money that he didn't commit that crime. Yet that's when you meet him, that's all you're really ever going to think about. That became his whole entire life. You know, he tried to get into magic, but not magic like pulling a rabbit out of a hat. Magic like, you know, CK witchcraft magic. But, you know, only his real intense fans followed him there. Did you find anything else with the Casey Anthony thing, or you were just excited because she was shopping for toys and you love to start a problem, Michael?
I mean, I genuinely couldn't even tell you what store she was in. Focused on something completely different.
Oh, her big fat ass?
It's dope.
Yeah.
It's so dope.
Yeah, but Casey Anthony was always good looking. We always knew that about her.
Okay, but, you know, she also got with the times.
We were so distracted by Casey Anthony's ass that now just sound prompts are going off.
I haven't used this package in a while, my bad.
Hey there, responsible wackos over the age of 21 living in states where Delta 8 is legal. Do you want to get high? Do you want to get really high? Do you, perchance, want to get really super duper legally buzzkill high? Well, now's the time to go to yodelta.com, where you can stock up on high quality lab tested Delta 8. You know, the shit works. It's a favorite in the studio. It's a favorite among comics and podcasters alike because it gets you high. You can get their vapes. You can get their gummies. And it's going to be a clean high that lasts. And the stuff tastes good, too. So if you're over the age of 21 and living in the majority of states where this is legal, you're going to head over to yodelta.com to stock up on Delta 8. What's Delta 8? Well, it's found in hemp and can be legally shipped to various states and get you high. At yodelta.com, you can find a mix of gummies and vapes for all of your getting stoned needs. I can tell you, I, Corinne Fisher, can tell you that Delta 8 works because I've seen it in action, unless these are the best actors on the goddamn planet, and that these products should be taken responsibly, as all products should. So once more, that's yodelta.com, the official Delta 8 sponsor of the GAS Digital Network. And if you use promo code GAS, that's G-A-S, you're going to get 25% off. Once more, that's promo code GAS for 25% off. Yo Delta, home of the Delta 8 that will get you super high. Now, back to Without a Country.
Take a deep breath.
That's everyone. I know we're just thrown off by Casey Anthony's big fat ass. We will move on with the show now. It's also because she's wearing jeans that were popular around the time that her daughter went missing. So that's part of the problem. No one wears jeans like that anymore. They're out of fashion. Okay.
They should come back.
I know. It's so funny because anytime like jeans evolve fashion wise, men are always angry because they just want them as tight as humanly possible. Like, you guys like low rise tight jeans like Britney Spears when she first came out. Okay. So moving on to the next story. Now we're getting more into the politics of the week that you guys all know and love and come here for. This is Tucker Carlson was fired. Tucker Carlson was fired. And apparently this is not surprising to many news outlets. So this first article is from the Washington Post. I did pull two articles about this because I think some of the like reasoning why he got fired that people are guessing is pretty interesting. So from the Washington Post, Tucker Carlson's abrupt Fox News exit fits with Murdoch playbook. This is by Frances Vanal. Tucker Carlson's sudden dismissal from his Fox News host position Monday was only the latest in a decades-long string of high-profile departures from Rupert Murdoch's media outlets. Whether they were based in the United States, Britain, or Australia, several employees who were previously lauded within the Murdoch business businesses have found themselves without a job, some with seemingly little warning. In a successful wrongful dismissal lawsuit, one former top Murdoch news editor in Australia characterized his 2008 termination as capricious and coming just after he had bought a house in the city where he worked. Carlson was fired a week after Fox settled a defamation lawsuit brought by Dominion Voting Systems, in which his private texts were publicly released. The messages showed Carlson being occasionally critical of Fox management and using misogynistic language. The network is also facing legal action from Abby Grossberg, a former booker for Carlson's show, who alleged she faced a sexist and hostile work environment. Fox is contesting her allegations, while Carlson has not publicly commented on the suit. And if you Google back like many years ago, there was also an article that was circulating through many news outlets about several people at Fox being accused of sexual assault, sexual misconduct, and one person even rape. That was not Tucker Carlson, but Sean Hannity was also involved in this. So a lot of these kind of like head honchos at Fox were being accused of these sort of things, kind of went away. But now a lot of people are kind of, you know, guesstimating, perhaps because of the heavy penalty that Fox has to pay to Dominion Voting Systems. As a reminder, last week we went over, it was like $787 million, that they need to kind of let go of some of their higher paid characters. There has, and also with the text message releases, that's also like kind of making people not look good. Although Fox in the past doesn't really care about people looking good or not. There has been an increase in high profile, especially when it comes to women. There has been an increase in high profile departures of Murdoch employees who face allegations of sexism and harassment since Lachlan Murdoch returned to the family business in 2014, said Patty Manning, author of The Successor, a biography of the eldest Murdoch son. Lachlan is now chief executive of Fox Corporation, the parent of Fox News, and was a key player in the decision to oust Carlson, the Washington Post has reported. Roger Ailes, who helped the Murdochs build a highly profitable and influential U.S. cable news network, was forced out in 2016 after a former Fox News anchor sued for sexual harassment and more than two dozen other women alleged that he engaged in sexually inappropriate behavior. Ailes, who died in 2017, denied the allegations at the time. Bill O'Reilly, Carlson's predecessor in Fox News' 8 p.m. primetime slot, was removed in 2017 after a string of sexual harassment allegations against him. He also denied the accusations. Both departures came after the start of the Me Too movement that seeks to combat sexual harassment and gender-based discrimination. Lachlan is pretty sensitive to accusations of a toxic work environment where sexual harassment is involved, said Manning. He added that many high-profile ousters were not due to one specific event, but a buildup and then a final last straw. Fox News did not immediately return a request for comment on how the Murdochs handled dismissals. Murdoch was notorious for the ruthless eviction of editors, for whom warning bells began to ring most loudly when their proprietor became effusive in their praise, the Glasgow Herald wrote in 1983. Harold Evans, promoted to editor of the Times of London after it was bought by Murdoch in 1981, wrote in a memoir that he was forced to resign after the media baron violated promises not to interfere in how the newspaper was run. One minute he's swimming along with a smile, and then snap, there's blood in the water, your head's gone, he quoted another Times journalist as saying about Murdoch. The senior Murdoch has said under oath to a British judicial inquiry that he fired Evans after being informed of a staff mutiny against their editor. Bruce Guthrie, who edited the Herald Sun, a Melbourne tabloid, was dismissed in 2008, less than 2 years after he was hired. He told an Australian court that he was let go because the newspaper's managing director did not believe they were getting along. Guthrie said that was not the case. The court awarded him damages of roughly $400,000 after finding he was wrongfully fired. Guthrie also wrote a book about his dismissal. Its title, Man Bites Murdoch, 4 decades in print, 6 days in court. So that's kind of reveal on it, on the whole situation going on, because everyone was pretty surprised, obviously, same day as Don Lemon was let go. Less kind of conspiracy theories surrounding that one. How Tucker Carlson took fringe conspiracy theories to a mass audience is Article 2. This is from NPR. Until his abrupt ouster on Monday, Tucker Carlson used his primetime Fox News show, the most watched hour on cable news, to inject a dark strain of conspiracy mongering into Republican politics, which obviously is kind of what the whole Dominion case is about. Not all of the conspiracy theories, but about one, that the election was somehow fucked up. He's railed against immigration, claiming it makes our own country poorer and dirtier and more divided. That sounds more like an opinion. He's called white supremacy a hoax and asserted hate speech is a made-up category designed to gut the First Amendment and shut you up. As Fox News' tentpole, drawing around 3 million viewers a night, Carlson's show has been both a source of that kind of nationalist, populist conservatism, that Donald Trump embodied, but it's also been a clearinghouse for conspiracies, said Nicole Hemmer, a history professor at Vanderbilt University who studies conservative media. Many of the false narratives Carlson promoted were part of the great replacement conspiracy theory, the racist fiction that non-white people are being brought into the U.S. to replace white voters. The theory was once considered the fringe territory of white nationalists, but thanks to Tucker Carlson, this kind of dreck that you would normally only see on a far-right forums and online spaces had a primetime audience on cable news every night, said Melissa Ryan of Card Strategies, which tracks disinformation and extremism online. I also think the fact that there are now so many news sources and so many specialists in misinformation popping up also is letting you know that just how on top of your resources you have to be when you're reading something. Where is this coming from? Who is writing this? Where is the bias? Carlson's show gave many Fox News viewers what they wanted, she said, including false claims about the 2020 election, COVID vaccines, and the January 6th Capitol insurrection, as well as smears against gay and transgender people and Russian propaganda about fictitious Ukrainian biolabs. Tucker is a chameleon, Ryan said. He's very good at reading the room and figuring out where the right wing base is at and adapting to give them as much red meat as they want. Yeah, he's a performer. During Trump's presidency, a 4chan to Fox to Trump pipeline emerged, Ryan said. In one notorious example, a conspiracy theory was circulating on the anonymous message board, falsely claiming South Africa was engaging in a genocide against white farmers. Tucker Carlson talked about it extensively on the air, and eventually Trump tweets about it and says that the United States is going to do something about it, she said. It's sort of insane to think about this content from these forums reaching the president of the United States and him saying, oh yeah, we're going to act. We're going to do something about what is a debunked, not true conspiracy theory. Carlson also gave a platform to controversial figures who shared his conspiratorial worldview, elevating their profiles as well. If you had been listening to, say, Alex Jones on InfoWars, you would have gotten this material, say, 3 months before Tucker Carlson got to it, Hemmer said. But it's showing up on Fox News, which was treated by other news organizations as a legitimate journalistic organization that has millions of more viewers and has viewers who haven't already been radicalized into these conspiracies. That makes Carlson so much more powerful and influential in the broader conservative movement. While his most inflammatory screeds sent some big-name advertisers fleeing, Carlson delivered ratings, the primary currency at Fox News. That's actually another really good point. It's not going to be as visible on television, but certainly on these videos that they're showing. I mean, possibly on televisions too, but you can tell, like, you can tell that Fox News is just like less legitimate by the pop-up ads that you get when you go to Fox News. Like, they're not as high end. It's like going to like an HTML fucking MySpace site as opposed to, you know, Washington Post or New York Times that have high caliber ads on them. So that is a problem. I mean, every place, you know, kind of. Yeah, I mean, actually, no, not every place. I was going to say every place has kind of like the, you know, upper right hand or lower right hand corner small ads, but you just don't see the ad space used in the same way on New York Times or Washington Post the way you do on Fox News. It's pretty brutal.
It's pretty awesome what you can do without a paywall.
What?
It's pretty awesome what you can do without a paywall.
Oh, because they're just accepting ads from everything.
I mean,
but a paywall does add legitimacy. Like, I feel like a paywall does add legitimacy and caliber to a project. And I mean, we are talking on a network that literally has a paywall.
Yeah, but I mean, all the stuff gets released for free eventually, unlike the Washington sure. Post, which is for the elites.
I mean, listen, you know, I am on record as saying many times, I think a lot of the problem with the left news sources and why we don't have more people on the left is because it is presented as elitist for sure. And many times I've talked about needing a Fox News for liberals. But that doesn't mean that I want like conspiracy theories from the left being spread. It means I just want a news source that dumbs down the news and uses smaller words that people who didn't go to college and even people like me who did go to college don't know what the fuck that it means. Because we don't just use news and legal jargon all day long because no one does. Back to the article now. Fox News is also very sensitive to what their audience wants and what their audience is saying, Hemmer said. As that audience has gotten more extreme, as conservative voters and activists have moved even further to the right or have embraced conspiratorial thinking, they've embraced media that give them that, Hemmer said. Right-wing upstarts like Newsmax and Rumble have expanded the universe of conservative media, but unlike its newer rivals, Fox News still has the reach of a mainstream news outlet. So, because there's also less choices. So that's the problem. Like when I think of like reputable right wing news sources, I actually wouldn't even include Fox. I would go to like The Hill I think is one of the more trustworthy news outlets on the right. And then I feel like there's a lot more places where people regularly get news on the left that are considered higher brow. Whereas on the right, you're going to start going into things like InfoWars or like Breitbart that just have too much bias and kind of wackiness to be fully trusted. So when it comes to, when it gives time to extremist conspiracy theories, like The Great Replacement, that reverberates beyond its airwaves. Tucker took something that really was relegated to the fringes, it's a white nationalist conspiracy theory, and made it not just part of his show, but then a broader part of Fox News's culture, and then by extension, Republican politics, said Angelo Carusone, president of liberal watchdog Media Matters for America. It really became acceptable to embrace that idea. Carlson's final show ended with a promotion for his latest streaming special called Let Them Eat Bugs. In it, he claims that global elites, another staple of Carlson's conspiracies, alongside racial grievance, are trying to force people to replace meat with insects. It's part of a larger agenda, Carlson warned. I'm not sure what the agenda would be in eating bugs. Are you familiar with this?
Yeah.
What would be the conspiracy?
Well, if you eliminate food sources, right, and you make it so that farmers can't live anymore, and you reduce everyone to eating like the protein from bugs that they can, you know, create in their own little factories, then, you know, anything that requires more dependence on government to survive.
Okay. Well, I mean, people but how is the government controlling the bugs? Wouldn't people start then farming bugs?
This would be the idea would be to just have these like large, you know, you do these like large mega cities, get everyone like into controlled dense populations, and then feed them bugs.
Okay, I'm gonna have to look into this because I still don't. I mean, many cultures have included bugs in their diet for many years. So it's not like it necessarily, you know, I watch a ton of food shows. That's probably like the thing I know most about after like pop culture and women's issues is like food and cooking. So, you know, the concept of eating bugs is not like some new American thing. I'm sure we would find a way to make it government controlled or fucking American bug factories and make them unhealthy when really they are actually a pretty healthy source of protein. Because it's like I could understand that if like people were all hunting animals on our own and then we were moving to something that was harder to get on your own. But that's not the case. Like, people are already depending on large companies, you know, that are associated with the Food and Drug Administration to get their food, unless you're part of some small, like, vegetable co-op in Brooklyn. All right. Well, we'll look into that. All right. Next, we have a Dylan Mulvaney update. So we discussed the Dylan Mulvaney Bud Light quote, in quotes, scandal last week. And we kind of were questioning whether or not it was really good for the transgender community for, you know, things like this. It's kind of another conversation that lots of folks in the LGBTQ plus community will have during Pride Month, like whether or not it's meaningful when a company makes rainbow, you know, covered packaging, and some members of the LGBTQ community will say, no, you're monetizing like our identity. And then others will argue that it's better to walk in. And this is actually I'm pulling this from an interview that will air later on Guys We Fucked. But, you know, other people will say it's better to walk into a Walmart and have someone who might feel homophobic be greeted with a bunch of rainbow flags during June rather than just not have those flags there at all. So those are two different. And so we were kind of talking about whether or not we thought, I don't want to say forcing, but like making the voice of Bud Light for a small period of time and not extensively a transgender woman, because it didn't really seem to fit with like the brand of Bud Light. It just didn't make sense. Bud Light's kind of like a low income white dude beer, I would call it. I mean, that's what it feels like to me. And again, I love Bud Light as a drink. So looked into this a little more, and I know Mike, you were kind of gung-ho on the fact that this was all on purpose to get us talking about Bud Light, but there have been a bunch of firings this week, which would then kind of suggest that that was not the case, unless these people were hired merely to be ultimately fired. Who the fuck knows? So this is from CBS News. Bud Light executives put on leave after Dylan Mulvaney uproar, report says. Two Anheuser-Busch InBev executives who supervise Bud Light's marketing collaboration with transgender TikTok star Dylan Mulvaney. Oh my God, these pop-ups. have been put on leave, the company told the Wall Street Journal on Sunday. Alyssa Heinerscheid, vice president of marketing for Bud Light, and her boss, Daniel Blake, Budweiser's group vice president for marketing, faced criticism and even death threats earlier this month. I like how they like act like death threats are like a huge deal, because honestly, just anyone who's a public person is getting them. This month, after sending the social media influencer commemorative Bud Light cans with her image to promote a sweepstakes contest for the company. Now, both executives have taken leaves of absence, the company said in an email to the journal. Given the circumstances, Alyssa has decided to take a leave of absence, which we support, an Anheuser-Busch spokesperson said in the email. Daniel has also decided to take a leave of absence. So it's like, okay, they decided to take a leave of absence. We don't really know who decided that for them. Did they decide that for themselves, or did Anheuser-Busch say, hey, we're deciding that you should decide to take a leave of absence? You never really fucking know in these situations. But it's like, I guess another way to look at it is like Anheuser-Busch hired these people that they knew would make these very progressive choices, but then they also knew that they were pretty disposable people and they didn't care whether they were going to stay or they were going to go. I guess that's another way to look at it. There's many reasons why this could be. The article goes on. The decision to go on leave wasn't voluntary on the executive's part, the journal reported, citing people familiar with the matter. Todd Allen, the former global president of Budweiser, will take on the role of vice president of marketing at Bud Light in place of Heiner Scheid. That's a rough last name. Ad Age reported. On April 1st, Mulvaney posted a sponsored Instagram video of herself drinking a Bud Light for a marketing campaign celebrating the end of March Madness. We already went over that. She was like, basketball, I don't know what the hell that says. And the post sparked outrage. Following the uproar, Anheuser-Busch InBev CEO Brendan Whitworth on April 14th released a statement in which he expressed regret over the division caused by the company's collaboration with Mulvaney, though he did not refer to the promotion directly. And then it goes on from fratty to inclusive. Bud Light's partnership with Mulvaney formed part of a larger initiative by the beer brand to evolve its marketing strategy. According to comments Heiner Scheid made on the Make Yourself at Home podcast earlier this month, Bud Light has traditionally targeted fratty men in its marketing campaigns and wanted to become more inclusive. I had this super clear mandate. It's like we need to evolve and elevate this incredibly iconic brand, Heiner Scheid said on the podcast. It means having a campaign that's truly inclusive and feels lighter and brighter and different and that appeals to women and to men. Since the controversy erupted over the link to Mulvaney, and I mean, even reading like, okay, so you read that paragraph and you say, okay, I understand. I'm coming into the company as a new employee. I understand what the company is looking for. I don't see going LGBTQ with this. I think that's the problem. I think that's the problem. There's so much focus on this group of people that is actually small, pretty small, especially if we're talking about the transgender community. And then you go, why don't you just appeal to women? That just, if you just go cis women, that would just have been a larger group. And also, wouldn't, I mean, if we're thinking just purely money strategy here, that would have just been the move. Like, it doesn't always have to be the most popular group that everyone's talking about at the moment, you know? I don't feel like this makes sense. I don't know who they're hiring or where these people are studying. Since the controversy erupted over the link to Mulvaney, Bud Light's sister brands have pivoted away from that inclusive tone. On April 14th, yeah, it's like if you're drinking Bud Light, you're going to need to take baby steps. I don't know what part of that a new hire wouldn't understand. On April 14th, Budweiser, another AB InBev-owned brand, tweeted a sleek new ad featuring patriotic overtones and its signature Clydesdale horse mascot. And I do have that. I mean, I have a clip of it from the Joe Rogan show where him and Jim Brewer just absolutely annihilating it. But I mean, what would you expect from those two? Transgender activists hope that other brands will continue partnering with transgender people, despite the backlash Bud Light faced from a small number of loud fringe anti-LGBTQ activists, GLAD president and CEO Sarah Kate Ellis told CBS Money Watch. When brands authentically portray LGBTQ people, I wouldn't describe anyone on TikTok as authentic. So that's a wild description. It reflects the world around us and improves the brand's reputation among all consumers, especially younger consumers. And that's what's important. I mean, I think the main thing here is that we want young people to become alcoholics. This is also an interesting play, okay, because yes, they want to target younger consumers, which probably is a big problem and a big talking point for alcohol companies now, because I don't know if you guys are familiar with the stats, but young people just aren't drinking nearly as much as the generations before them. Gen Z much more into drugs, psychedelics, marijuana, etc. Not as big on drinking. It's just not as big on drinking. And so I think a lot of alcohol companies are probably in a crunch, the same way I'm sure cigarette companies are. It's like, how are we going to keep selling this thing and getting people addicted to this thing that people are just less interested in now? So that could also have been part of the play and why they went kind of towards something that really is much more accepted by people who in Gen Z and then possibly millennials. AB InBev's stock took a brief hit from the backlash, but has since recovered, trading at close to $66 a share on Monday. The brewery, which also owns brands such as Corona and Stella Artois, is up nearly 4% in the past month and has risen roughly 11% from last year. Probably because people didn't do their research and then were just like, I need to drink another beer that's not from Budweiser. And they just assumed that Corona and Stella Artois were made in like Mexico and France, you know? Yeah. Michael, did you need to say something? Looked like you were having a moment.
I was having this conversation like with my mom, who is like the...
Who is transgender.
She's... That would rule. Formerly my dad, now mom. No, she is like, she's Tucker's like base. You know what I mean? Like,
uh-oh.
Her and my dad do not miss an episode of Tucker Weekly.
Well, now they're about to miss all of them.
She was like freaking out about this thing. Like, you know, oh, this company's losing a ton of money. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Do you really think that Budweiser is going to take a hit long term in this?
Well, of course it wasn't going to be long term. Yeah, like no one ever thought it was. That's why I was actually surprised after
our
discussion.
Mistaken. Boomers do think that this is the end of Bud Light.
No, I know. That's like when they, you know, that's like when they'll, you know, they'll, people will stop buying like Goya beans. It's like Goya, the oldest brand in the supermarket. They're not going anywhere. Goya's so confident in who they are as a bean company. They haven't changed that fucking label since 1978. Like that label is like printed off an inkjet printer from your Microsoft PC. It's not going anywhere. I love that. What a dick swing. They go, it's beans. Fucking get it or don't get it. Also, I forgot to get water and my allergies are killing me. Can someone bring me a cup of water, please? Thank you so much. Like coughing up my whole life back here. Yeah. And did you see the new commercial that they released with the Clydesdale? It's on this ABC Chicago.
It made me feel patriotic.
Okay. Do you want to play it for everyone?
Yeah, can I get you water first?
Oh, I didn't know. I thought there's two people back there. I thought one could do one and one could do the other.
Yeah, I mean, well, yeah. It's okay, you want to do that?
The whole company shut down because Corinne was dehydrated over here in the booth. You guys, I just wanted you to know that usually every week I get my own water. This week I just forgot to get my own water because there's an ad.
Just a minute.
So many people in the studio. Yeah, but I think this one particular one might also feature Rogan and Jim Brewer, but it was hard to find the commercial without those two in it. Oh, thank you so much, Mr. Harrington. Wow, just water spilling everywhere. That was wild delivery. I hope you've never worked in food services. Have you ever been a waiter before? Okay. And it shows.
Let me tell you a story about a beer.
There's a Clydesdale.
Rooted in the heart of America.
Oh, they're in St. Louis.
The Budweiser ad campaign that Anheuser-Busch hopes will help the company ride out a boycott. It features the nostalgia of an iconic Clydesdale galloping through all American.
This poor horse, all the places it had to go. So it's galloping. It's on the beach now.
It's a little gay.
This is a beautiful horse. Oh no! You think that was gay?
It was a lot of dudes like getting real close and holding hands and passing each other beers.
Yeah.
Maybe just with the sound off, it feels gayer.
Right. I think. Well, I also think it's like a horse galloping through.
To be fair, that's also how most Fast and Furious movies explain plot.
With a horse?
No, just dudes passing each other's beers saying, tell me what you remember about your father.
Fast and Furious really is insight into men's mental health, you know? Like there's not a lot of talking about feelings going on.
I don't know about you. I see that Bud Light commercial, I just want to stand up and say the Pledge of Allegiance.
Really? Wow. How often do you get that feeling, Mike?
And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free.
Funny anecdote about that song. When it used to play on the radio, I would stand up and put my hand over my heart in my bedroom growing up in New Jersey.
At the part where he said says, and I'll stand up.
Well, not, no, I was
next to you and defender still today.
I would do it for the whole song. That song just really.
Wait, you would do the whole Pledge of Allegiance then?
That would just really evoke the sense of patriotism inside my soul.
It drew your day to a screeching halt. Yeah. You're like, now I gotta stand for this whole fucking thing.
I would literally, because I would listen to the radio as I was doing my homework in my bedroom, and I, you know, listen to the, you know, the 9 at 9, the 10 at 10, whatever on Z100, and you know, but sometimes I feel like that song was like hotter on maybe like PLJ because they would sometimes like play country music. I don't know. Cause I listened to a little bit of country growing up as well. And I feel like that was hot on the country stations. You know, that's the night that the lights went out in Georgia, all the hits.
What about, Courtesy of the Red, White, and Blue?
I am familiar with that one. That one didn't kind of bring out the feels in me in the same way. There was just something about Proud to Be an American that it was like really like. That hit home
this
for
is
some
all
reason.
Just very, I was raised around 9/11 vibes.
That's well, I mean, I was in high school at 9/11. I was already pretty much raised by 9/11.
Dude, I was in the eighth grade and I was not. That rocked my world.
I know you. 9/11 rocked your world.
Yeah.
Really?
Yes. For like most kids. Like, you're an outlier if 9/11 was not a turning point in your life.
What are you talking? What? A turning point in your life, but did anyone you know die in 9/11?
I mean, a couple kids where I went to middle school with, their parents died.
Okay, but so how is that a turning point in your life?
Because
it really was not a turning point in my life, Michael. I mean, it's something I obviously, a historic moment that I remember vividly, and I remember the day and what happened in the school, but like, did it change anything personally about my life besides the fact that I have to take my shoes off at the airport? Absolutely not.
That didn't come for a few years later, but the. It was an attack on American soil. It hasn't happened since Pearl Harbor.
Right. Yeah. I mean, to me, it was like, yeah, we should have been ready for this. We got too fucking high on our horses. I can't believe this affected you so much and that I'm only just finding this out about you now.
Okay, in the comments.
Guy, call in if 9/11 affected. And I'm not talking about if someone very close to you died, that I don't want to hear from you. Of course you were affected and I'm deeply sorry for your loss. I am talking about if you're
save it. If your dad died, save it.
Mine's dead too. Shut the fuck up. I am talking if you were just a fucking kid in a middle school and 9/11 happened and your trajectory of life completely changed, please call me now because I need to discuss this with you. This is wild.
573 Gasline. Also, if you're watching on YouTube, leave it in the comments that I'm not crazy.
Now, I just... So, like, did you get anxiety that, like, a terrorist was going to attack? Or, like, what? How did it change your life?
I mean, it genuinely made me want to go join the Marines to go and kill the evildoers.
Okay, and then why didn't you? You realized you had to run, or?
You bitch.
You're fucking rude to me all the time on this show.
No, I was busy being in a rehab for my 18th birthday. It was a whole to-do. But.
Right. Sorry. He was going to help save, but then he got a little high on the juice.
Yeah. I started doing drugs because of 9/11.
You're out of your fucking mind. You're out of your mind.
I would be a C-level executive if it hadn't been 500 company.
For that pesky Osama bin Laden. Wait, fuck. Natalie, how old were you when 9/11? You were really young.
I was four, yeah. I was going to say, does it give me more validity or less validity that it changed my... I feel like it made an impact on my childhood, but also I was four. So,
okay.
Like...
So how... Oh, okay, do you remember...
No, not really.
Right.
But also my uncle died in 9/11, so I feel like...
Well, you don't count then, Natalie. Weren't you listening to...
But I didn't know him like that. I was four. I don't really remember him.
Right, because of 9/11. Okay, but so then, other than the loss of your uncle, which I'm sure affected your parents, how did 9/11 affect you?
I feel like it was relevant in... Sorry, we're getting a call, so we might have to...
Okay, uh-oh.
But,
the 9/11 hotline.
I feel
not
like...
Not to be confused with 911.
There was I don't know, I feel like it was just there was a lot of 9/11 posters up in my school all of a sudden. There was a
so
lot
was
of never
a,
forget.
It was a visual and tonality aspect change.
It feels like they were constantly reminding us.
Well, yeah, that was the whole thing.
They were like, yeah, don't forget.
To me, this is like someone who wasn't sexually assaulted saying that the Me Too movement drastically actually, and that I could even see more because it's like it's a societal change. Like 9/11 wasn't a societal change unless you like say that people just being more racist against like brown people was the societal change. Uh-oh.
I feel like it. We're getting details. Sorry. I feel like if you lived in New York, it was kind of a thing.
Right. I mean, I lived in New Jersey. I saw the smoke from the towers from my school. And I felt very bad for the people whose parents died. But other than that, my life went on.
Dustin from Kentucky has something to add.
Wow. I love to know what, I love to know what happened in Kentucky that changed his life forever on 9/11. Hi, Dustin. You're on Without a Country. Uh-oh. They got him. Terrace got him. Dustin, are you there? No, we lost him.
Says he's still on. I don't know what's going on.
Oh, maybe he had it. Maybe he got nervous.
Yeah, got stage fright.
I'm here.
Oh, there we go.
Oh, Dustin, hello. Okay, so you're on the line to talk about how 9/11 impacted your life even though no one you love died. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I'm from like small town in Kentucky, so like it didn't have a direct effect on me. But what
you
I'm
don't
saying
say.
Is like I can relate to Harrington on the point of like that's the point where it kind of changed my perspective and made me aware of that shit like that could actually happen. Like, because I felt like, oh, I'm safe. We live in America. Nobody can touch us. You know.
Okay.
Beautiful
so
life, everything. And then when that happened, it was like, oh, we could fucking die. Like, there could be a terrorist attack at any point. Like.
Okay, so
it made me a bit more patriotic.
Okay, so it was more like an existential thing. Well, I don't know, but Mike, I don't know why you're putting your fist in the air. I can understand this. So this was like me. How old were you on 9/11, Dustin?
I don't know, I was in like third grade.
You were in third grade. Okay, so very young. And so, and that was the kind of, okay, I can understand this. So this is something then that you went on, you know, you're 8 years old or so, and you thought about this a lot, that you could die at any moment.
I mean, I didn't just sit there in class and be like, oh, my God, I'm going to die. But, like, it made me aware, and it was kind of like a reality check at a young age that something like that could happen.
And was that your first experience with death, or had you, like, been to relatives' funerals before or anything like that? Anyone in your family had died?
No.
No. Okay. Okay. All right. Well, thank you for calling. Okay. So that gives me a little more insight. I can understand just conceptually that if that is the first large scale news thing that you see when you're a kid, where a lot of people die, that then teaches you that life is not, your life is not necessarily protected because of where you live. I understand that. And I think it's also different because I just have, since I was like very, very little, was going to relatives' funerals. Because I'm the oldest kid in my family, so I just got to watch everyone die. So I think that there's something about that I already knew the existence of mortality and how close it was. Okay, that call helped me understand a little bit more. And is that, do you feel the same way Dustin feels, Mike, or was it different for you?
I mean, it was a little bit closer to home. Like you were saying, I could see the smoke from the towers, and it's like, man.
You got a Dustin accent? You just
it just comes out when you're feeling patriotic, when you just want to stand up and let them terrorists know they ain't gonna beat us. Yeah, it comes out.
Oh my God, it's interesting because I do remember kind of. Oh, God, I wrote a really funny diary entry on 9/11. I have to go and see if I can find this because I, like, drew pictures of the terrorists and stuff. And I guess if you want to call, like, getting a sense of hate in your heart for a group of people that you never met before, you know, patriotism, I feel like that's how, like, people are, like, interpreting patriotism. And I don't necessarily know that I would agree with that as an adult because that's what happened. To me, there was, like, a huge racism problem after 9/11 against brown people, and that was, I certainly thought that was strange, you know. And I also remember in my diary entry that I was kind of like, fuck, this sucks, but also like, wow, this group of people really believed in a cause and they went out and they did something about it. Like, I do remember thinking that because I just, I guess, was around low motivation people. And it was nice to see someone really fully execute a plan. I'm not shitting you. I have to find this fucking diary entry anyway. All right. Well, now we all get a sense of what makes people feel patriotic at Gas Digital. And as always, it is and was alarming. All right. Speaking of terrorism, this is more terrorism from within our own country. This is from Fox News. Washington governor signs big gun control package, including assault weapons ban. Quote, no one needs an AR-15. Many semi-automatic rifles now illegal to buy in Washington state under one of three new gun control laws. Okay, I had to click on the author because from the small picture, she looked really hot, but she's actually not. So sorry about that. That's why I got distracted. The mood at the Washington State Capitol was jubilant Tuesday as Governor Jay Inslee signed a trio of gun control bills, one of which immediately bans the manufacture, purchase, or importation of so-called assault weapons. Party safely tonight, the governor told supporters after signing the bills. Inslee and Attorney General Bob Ferguson, both Democrats, pushed for the gun control package. With the governor's signature, Washington becomes the 10th state to adopt an assault weapons ban. No one needs an AR-15 to protect your family, Inslee said, while surrounded by family members of shooting victims. You only need it to kill other families. Earlier this session, lawmakers passed a bill that mandates safety training and requires a 10-day waiting period to buy a gun, as well as a bill that requires gun makers and dealers to take reasonable steps to keep their products out of the hands of dangerous individuals. And I think that the 10-day waiting period is great for something like a school shooting, something like a domestic violence thing where it's in the heat of the moment. But we see that it is not helpful when it comes to school shootings, because like if you have a plan to shoot up a school, you can wait 10 days. You know, there's 180 school days in a year. The bill that requires safety training and a waiting period takes effect January 1st, 2024. So get those shootings in now, kids. We lead the country in so many ways and we are leading on this, Inslee said. I'm not sure any state has ever taken three steps on one day. Oh, what a sad little story about America. Inslee added that while he and supporters celebrate the bills, there remains more to do in the fight against gun violence. We know we need to continue this effort on a national basis, he said. The road to the assault weapons ban has been long, Ferguson said. He first pushed for it 7 years ago after the deadly shooting at a... What is this word? Mukilteo house party? I don't even remember that. There's so many shootings, I don't even remember that one. A lawsuit challenging the assault weapons ban was announced almost simultaneously with Tuesday's bill signing. The Second Amendment Foundation filed a complaint in the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Washington, accusing lawmakers of violating the Second Amendment with an outright ban on semi-automatic rifles. The state has put politics ahead of constitutional rights and is penalizing law-abiding citizens, while this legislation does nothing to arrest and prosecute criminals who misuse firearms in defiance of all existing gun control laws. ASF founder Alan M. Gottlieb said in a press release, it is absurd. The NRA has also signaled opposition to at least two of the bills and said the organization already has lawsuits working their way through the courts against similar bans in California, Delaware, and Illinois. Ferguson said his office is prepared to defend the bills in court. We're a nation of laws, and they have the right to challenge that, he said. Our record so far is pretty good against the NRA and against the Second Amendment Foundation. We are undefeated, and we plan to keep that record intact. I wish I had a gun noise that was like, ch-ch. All right. So that's that. It's nice to see, you know, someone doing something about gun control other than saying thoughts and prayers. That's exciting. Like that. Man eaten alive by bugs in jail. Woo! It's a little bug theme today, guys. A little bug theme. This is from the Washington Post. This is just, you know, I'm pretty interested in incarceration these days and how there's overcrowding, how prisons are privately owned, how it's all part of the larger nonsense that is capitalism, and how we really don't even attempt to rehabilitate most inmates. And also many people are in there who didn't commit crimes or who are in there for minor drug crimes for way, way too fucking long. So just kind of keeping my eye on incarceration. I'm kind of obsessed with the Positive Change program, which pairs rescue dogs with inmates and they rehabilitate each other. So, you know, this is just something as I continue my quest and my journey to find a purpose in my life. I previously had a purpose. I feel like I fulfilled that purpose, you know, and now I need to move on to something new. So this is part of that quest. And this is from the Washington Post. Man died after being eaten alive by bugs in filthy jail cell, family says. LaShawn Thompson was slumped over in a cell at the Fulton County Jail in Atlanta when a detention officer came to check on him in September. And there's a photo, and this place is fucking filthy. Okay? Filthy. The cell was so dirty that a worker who entered it wore a safety suit designed to protect from hazardous materials, according to jail records. Officers were unable to resuscitate Thompson in the cell, where he'd been held for around 3 months. An autopsy could not determine his cause of death, but the report described an extremely severe infestation of small insects across Thompson's body. His face, upper and lower extremities were pockmarked with cuts and lesions from repeated skin picking, the report said. But to Thompson's family, the cause of his death is clear. Thompson was eaten alive, in quotes, by insects and bed bugs, Michael Harper, an attorney for Thompson's family, said in a news release Wednesday. The release, accompanied by jail records and graphic photos of Thompson and his cell, called for a criminal investigation into the 35-year-old man's death and for the Fulton County Jail to be shuttered and replaced. They put that man in that cell, left him there to die, Harper said in a Thursday news conference, and that's exactly what happened. The family is working with doctors to investigate Thompson's death, Harper added. Brad McCray, Thompson's brother, told the Washington Post his family is shaken by the conditions detailed in the report and the photos that show the extent of the infestation across Thompson's body. The family decided to release the photos to illustrate the abuse he suffered, Harper's release said. It's heartbreaking, McCray said. The pictures are really awful. They're hard to look at. The Fulton County Sheriff's Office, which operates the jail, did not immediately respond to a request for comment Thursday night. In a statement to WSB-TV, a spokesperson said the office was investigating Thompson's death and had approved funds to address infestations and diseases at the jail. The statement also echoed Harper's calls to replace the jail. It's no secret that the dilapidated and rapidly eroding conditions of the current facility make it incredibly difficult to meet the goal of providing a clean, well-maintained, and healthy environment for all inmates and staff, this statement said. Harper told the Post the family appreciated that officials are working to improve some conditions, but called for further action. If you look at those pictures, how deplorable that jail cell was. How did they get to that point in the first place, he said. It's not fit for an animal. Also, I hate when people say that because it's like animals shouldn't be living like that either, guys. No living being should be living like that. Thompson was a playful man who grew up wanting to be a doctor, McCray said. He loved dancing and baking strawberry cakes. And I hate these part of articles. I understand that we want to honor it and humanize these people, but just give me the fucking news. Thompson was arrested on a charge of misdemeanor simple battery in June. Court records show he was held at the Fulton County Jail and awaiting transfer to an Alabama jail for a prior charge, Harper said. Officers moved Thompson to the psychiatric wing of the jail after determining he had mental health issues, according to Harper. Thompson's family, who lives in Alabama, did not know he had been detained until they received a call informing them of his death, they said at the news conference. Harper said the family had only recently obtained the jail records and decided to release them. McCray said the graphic photos of his brother brought to mind images from a landmark moment in America's history of racial injustice. The first thing that came to my mind was seeing the photos of Emmett Till, he said, referencing the 14-year-old black boy tortured and lynched in Mississippi in 1955, who, at his family's insistence, was photographed at an open casket funeral to show the brutality of his death. And I do recommend you look at those photos if you've never seen them. It is a historical disgrace. Thompson was healthy and had no pre-existing physical health conditions before being jailed, Harper said. He alleged that jail staff noticed Thompson's condition deteriorate over the months he was detained, but did not help him, citing jail records and photos of the squalid condition of Thompson's cell. That cell was covered in filth and lice when officers found him unresponsive in September, according to the jail's incident report. Another report from the Fulton County Medical Examiner called the insects bed bugs. And this is crazy because both lice and bed bugs are known for how fast they spread. The officer who first found him, quote, freaked out and did not immediately administer CPR, a Fulton County jail supervisor said in the jail's incident report. Thompson's family has not yet taken legal action, but intends to once they hear back from doctors evaluating Thompson's death, Harper said. But he said in Thursday's conference that he hoped for change outside the courtroom. It is a situation there needs to be resolved systemically, Harper said. I mean, of course, this is a huge problem. Again, something that's like not, we see a story here and there about it, similar to domestic violence. But I think if you kind of put together all the articles that are slid out over the course of the year about fucked up shit happening in jails, that you would have quite a thick package on your hands. Okay. All right. Now moving on to our main story. It's not a specific story so much as it is the Presidential Watch 2024. If you missed it, it is official. Joe Biden will be running for re-election in 2024. We thought it was going to happen, but it's now officially been announced. It will be Biden and Harris once again running for the Democrats, which probably is the best move. Usually, if you're already the sitting president, we kind of looked into this previously. You're basically, 99.9% of the time, you're going to run again because you're already the president. People feel safe and comfortable with you. And so Politico had some really good articles about this. And this is called Biden's Running, Which Republican Has the Best Chance of Beating Him? And this is something we've been talking about for quite some time on the show, because I didn't want to lose sight of the 2024 election. I feel like when we stop talking about things, when we lose sight of things, that's when we really get our asses handed to us, especially when it comes to being a Democrat. This says, as President Joe Biden kicks off his reelection bid, he begins from a position of weakness. The president has been underwater in the polls for close to 2 years. His approval ratings dropped under 50% around the time of the chaotic Afghanistan pullout in August 2021 and never truly recovered. Only three post-war presidents, Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan, and Donald Trump, were in a worse polling spot at this point in their reelection campaigns, and two of those three lost. Yet Biden won't be easy pickings for the GOP. Over the past 75 years, only two Democrats won a higher percentage of the popular vote than Biden, Barack Obama in 2008 and Lyndon Johnson in 1964. And Biden carries the formidable advantages of incumbency, along with a largely united party behind him. As the 2024 campaign begins in earnest, the pandemic is effectively over, the economy is showing resilience, and the GOP faces the prospect of a demolition derby primary. Most importantly, Biden proved in 2020 that not only could he rebuild the so-called blue wall, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, he could snag increasingly purple Arizona and Georgia. So which Republican contender is best positioned to take on Biden and win back those swing states? Here's a clear-eyed look at their strengths and weaknesses. I'm only going to go through Donald Trump and Ron DeSantis for this, because I think those are the only two realistic choices for who is going to be running against him. So twice, this is about President Donald Trump, or former President Donald Trump, twice impeached, once indicted, the only president since the advent of polling whose approval ratings never cracked 50%. Trump doesn't exactly cut the profile of a model challenger. Even in his two presidential runs, his high water mark in the popular vote was just under 47%. But in 2016, he showed that there was a path to an electoral college win nonetheless. In a rematch with Biden, Trump would likely be better politically positioned than many of his GOP rivals on issues like entitlement reform and abortion, where he's tacked a bit more to the center. Still, there is the matter of the five states that Biden flipped in 2020. Trump wouldn't need to win all of them back to recapture the White House, but he would likely need at least three of those states, and none of them is a slam dunk. That's not because of Biden's strengths, but Trump's flaws. There are clear signs of a more professionalized Trump campaign operation than in the past, but still, Trump is Trump. See, for example, his Easter message on the holiest day on the Christian calendar. The swing states that will decide the 2024 election are among those that have been the most destabilized by Trump's polarizing politics, either because of his conflicts with the state parties or the forces unleashed by his baseless claims of election fraud. Take Georgia, the 2022 Republican primary. There represented a massive repudiation of the former president. The cherry on top came in December, in the December Senate runoff, when Trump's handpicked nominee Herschel Walker was defeated. In Arizona, ground zero for election denialism, the Trump-endorsed statewide candidates crashed and burned in November. Biden was no asset to Democrats in 2022, but Trump was equally damaging. While 38% of Arizona voters said they cast their votes to oppose Biden, according to exit polls, 35% said their votes were to oppose Trump. The blue wall that Trump cracked in 2016 is equally daunting. Democrats are now in ascendance in Michigan and Pennsylvania, which have moved in tandem in presidential elections for close to 40 years, in no small part due to a backlash against Trump in their most populous suburbs. Short of a massive rural turnout in those states or a black swan event, Biden has a decided edge against Trump in both places. In Wisconsin, the closest of the three states in 2020, a mere 20,000 votes separated Biden and Trump. But the trend lines for the GOP aren't promising there either. In both 2016 and 2020, Trump ran behind traditional Republican margins in the conservative suburbs of Milwaukee that are essential to GOP chances. Worse, the Trump era has seen the rise of liberal Dane County as an electoral powerhouse. Witness the recent state Supreme Court election, and a Trump-led GOP ticket is guaranteed to generate another monster turnout there. All right, so that's their assessment of Donald Trump. Now we move on to Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who I know, you know, as of last week was flailing a bit in the polls compared to Trump. But I just still think if I'm a Republican, this is who I want to see. And this is who I think could really be like, it's like kind of like we know Trump. We know his antics. We know what he has to offer. And I just think like this is the move. I think it's not only the short term move, but I think it's also the long term move for Republicans. Anyway, not that I want them to win. I mean, I hope they pick someone bad, but I think if I'm Republican, this is the move. In the view of many Republican officials, DeSantis is Trump without the baggage and drama. If he runs, they envision a conservative big state governor fresh off a landslide reelection, prosecuting a vigorous case against an enfeebled Biden, an incumbent who's nearly twice his age. It's true that DeSantis might staunch the bleeding in traditionally Republican suburbs, particularly across the Sun Belt, while maintaining the other elements of the MAGA coalition. Just as important, his robust performance among all Latino groups in Florida in his 2022 reelection caught both parties' attention. He outpaced even Trump's 2020 Latino gains. That hair. But the governor's recent stumbles have raised real questions about how he'd fare on the national stage under the relentless pressures of a presidential election, where there is no place for the press-averse DeSantis to hide from the media. And the disciplined approach and sharp political instincts that enabled his rapid rise on the national scene haven't been sufficient to shield him from Trump's assault. Also, it's very interesting, DeSantis kind of took the Beyonce approach, press-averse. You can get a lot higher if you just kind of make these money moves, make these power moves, talk less, do more, then get to the top. If he does emerge from a smash mouth primary against Trump, and with Trump, there is no other kind, DeSantis will enter the general election against Biden with deep scars to show for it. In presidential elections, governors typically face questions about their lack of foreign policy experience, and DeSantis's description of Russia's war in Ukraine as a territorial dispute, which he later walked back amid bipartisan criticism, will only bolster the case for Biden as an experienced hand. I also think a possible approach for Ron DeSantis here, because if you let Trump talk, like, yes, he will attack you, but also he will most likely put his foot in his mouth. So kind of let him talk a lot more. And I think he'll eventually, if you don't try to, like, you know, give him punch for punch, I think, yeah, you probably will lose if you try to go at Trump punch for punch. But if you kind of sit back, let him put his foot in his mouth, I think that could be an interesting strategy. All right. Yet that stance may not be nearly so politically problematic as the bill he signed recently banning abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy. DeSantis, who is expected to announce his candidacy in May after the legislative session, may have advanced his prospects in a GOP primary, but polling and recent election results in the swing states that will decide the presidency suggests his position could be a millstone. If DeSantis is the GOP nominee, the ban makes it more likely than ever that abortion rights will be a central issue in 2024, which when Roe v. Wade was repealed, we kind of talked about that and how it affected people, Republicans, in a lot more detrimental way than we thought it would have. Because across the board, it much more people are pro-choice than they are anti-choice, drowning out the other issues where Biden would be more vulnerable. Okay, so then the next choices are Vice President Mike Pence, Nikki Haley, South Carolina Senator Tim Scott, a couple other people, but I don't think any of those are likely. So it's like, why are we going to waste our time on these people? Maybe we'll see them in the future. Maybe we'll get into them in the future. But Pence, I just definitely don't think that's happening.
Really? You don't think we're going to see President Pence?
No. No. I don't. At no point did I think we were ever going to see President Pence, quite honestly. After the fly on the head incident. Just never happening. Okay. So that's that. I wanted to see I didn't really find any Republican sources that I loved. There is another political news article that I really loved. See if you can find something from the right in the meantime that you think is like giving us more information. But to me, Politico did the best job on the election announcement that we got this week. So this is also from Politico. More obstacles for DeSantis' still unannounced 2024 campaign. I'm particularly interested in this because I want to see, again, I think DeSantis is the move, but I'm very interested to see what people are saying is his downfall. And I think in this case, it's fine to kind of, you know, get this from a conservative or a liberal news source, because it's like, well, we're going to have someone from the Republican Party and someone from the Democratic Party anyway. So it's like, you know, a critique of them, where it's from, doesn't really matter as long as you're familiar with politics. All right. So it says, hello and welcome to Tuesday. President Joe Biden formally announced he's running for a second term this morning. And his introductory video includes an image of Florida Governor Ron DeSantis while Biden talks about MAGA extremists. Meanwhile, the governor's anticipated presidential campaign is starting off another week with some caution flags. Number one, first off came the news out of New York that Republican Lee Zeldin, who unsuccessfully ran for governor in the Empire State, was endorsing former President Donald Trump. This was a bit stunning given that DeSantis campaigned for Zeldin and Zeldin introduced the governor at a law enforcement event held on Staten Island in February, where he effusively praised DeSantis. Number two, the New York Times is out this morning with a story suggesting that hedge fund billionaire Ken Griffin, who was one of DeSantis's big donors during his reelection, may not be as locked in on backing the governor as he sounded just a few months ago. The story also says Griffin and DeSantis met in Florida in the last 2 weeks. And I mean, that could come. There's a lot of things that have happened, especially with Trump in the meantime, as far as the indictment and seeing if he was interested in running, all these kinds of things. Number three, the Trump campaign keeps unloading on DeSantis. They dropped a minute-long ad on social media Monday evening that contends DeSantis was destined for political irrelevancy until Trump endorsed him in 2018. A real, I made you and I can break you stance. The spot includes snippets of DeSantis's Trump-centric ad from the campaign that included footage of him building a wall with one of his children and reading from The Art of the Deal. It also includes this DeSantis quote. I'd like to thank our president for standing by me when it wasn't necessarily the smart thing to do. The ad says instead of being grateful, DeSantis is, quote, attacking the president. Response. All of this follows a week in which DeSantis has been seen many in Florida's congressional delegation throw support to Trump instead of him. And I think that probably has to do with the polls now skewing a lot more in Trump's favor, as we went over last week. But those in DeSantis's greater orbit continue to shrug off the latest developments. Never Back Down spokesperson told Insider that Trump had nearly universal GOP support in 2020 and that many Republicans don't want him to run again in 2024. The Super PAC also touted a Nevada poll that showed that DeSantis is edging President Joe Biden in the battleground state while Trump trails Biden by a single point. Riding with the governor. Another notable trend, many conservatives who became fans of DeSantis over the last couple of years have been voicing their support as well in the last few days, with one columnist calling some of Trump's recent bashing of DeSantis lies. It will be interesting to see if the courting of conservative influencers is enough to counter the headwinds now buffeting DeSantis. Governor DeSantis is currently on an international trade mission this week that is taking him to Japan, South Korea, Israel, and the United Kingdom. So yeah, that's kind of where we're at right now with those two. Again, I really can't believe that after all this time, Trump is still like has as many supporters as he does. I almost think that him being banned from Twitter and him getting off our minds, like, almost made people miss him more. Like, I think if he had been in our faces continuously for this period where, you know, that this 4 years where he lost the presidency and Biden is in the White House, that we would have been tired of his same old shenanigans. But it really is a case of, like, absence makes the heart grow fonder. I feel like people miss him. I feel like he was exciting. And people miss him. And people miss the antics. And people were like, yo, Trump, let's get back together. Michael, did you find anything that was interesting or had any other information from any conservative outlets?
A couple right-wing sources. Fox News just has an article on Biden's potential staffers for his 2024 campaign.
Right.
And let me see here. The other one is a GOP presidential candidate says that Tucker Carlson would be a good addition to the 2024 field.
Oh, that's interesting.
I'll tell you right now.
Your mom's voting.
I'd vote for him.
You'd vote for Tucker Carlson.
Yes, in a heartbeat, Corinne.
Okay, so wait, who are they saying to add him to? DeSantis' team, you said, or Trump's team?
No, it's saying just...
Make him president, because I think that's a very interesting move to tack him on as a vice president, because I don't think at this point Pence and Trump have been through too much. Like, Pence can't run, is not going to run with Trump because he's trying to get president himself. I mean, I guess, you know, it's always one of the people who's running for president who then gets knocked out, who ends up becoming the VP, as we saw with Kamala. But I don't think that would happen because I think Pence and Trump are on pretty bad terms at this point.
The quote is, it's from this guy, Vivek Ramaswamy.
Okay.
Who is a conservative investor.
Mm-hmm.
He said here, I think he'd be a good addition to the race. I think people should only do this if they feel called to do it, but I think it would
called,
be
called, yes.
Yeah.
Like the Lord called you to do it. Uh-huh.
Like, you know, these are modern day Joan of Arcs.
Right.
But I think it'd be good for the country if he got in, to be honest with you. There's definitely a thought leadership vacuum in political media across the political spectrum, and Tucker was one of the great political thinkers and commentators of our time.
And that is interesting, because when you think, like, that was the highest ranking personality on Fox News, that is very interesting.
On cable, period.
Yeah, yeah, that's very, very, very interesting. And, like, he's not a bad looking guy, and I think that really does actually affect your affect what people think of you. People,
family man?
People are more into, how is he a family man? Because he has a family?
Tucker Carlson? Yeah, I mean, more versus Trump, who's on his ninth wife, is what I'm saying.
That doesn't seem to bother people when it comes to men. It really doesn't.
No, people.
I mean, he's literally been accused of rape and no one batted an eyelash.
People have batted plenty of eyelashes.
I don't know that they were batting eyelashes. Honestly, like, the things that made people mad, that didn't seem to be at the top of the list, which, believe me, I noticed.
Look. At the end of the day, people
at
do
the, end of the, day.
The American family,
yeah.
Right? The
yeah.
The heartland voter.
Oh, we got to now is the first time you'll be commentating as a father.
As a father, mm-hmm. I trust somebody like Tucker way more than I trust somebody like Trump.
Okay,
goes without saying.
You trust Tucker, even though it's been revealed that he's, like, been accused of sexual assault. He uses misogynistic language against his employees.
Whoa. He was not accused of sexual assault.
Yes,
he was accused of sexism.
No, sexual assault, too.
I got to look into this, because yeah. This is the first I'm hearing of this.
It's like a 2010 article. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, we talked about it earlier on the show. Yeah, Fox News and host sued in sexual harassment suit. So sexual harassment, not sexual assault, but some those are a little bit, you know, but it's yeah. So two women, this is not even that long ago. This is 2020, actually. This is from Political also. Two women accused male Fox News hosts of sexual harassment and, in one woman's case, rape in a lawsuit filed on Monday in federal court in New York. Ed Henry, who was fired as a host earlier this month, I don't even know who that is, was accused of sexual harassment and rape in the suit, while hosts Sean Hannity, Tucker Carlson, and Howard Kurtz were alleged to have separately behaved in a sexually inappropriate way. So, yes, it is sexual. It is not sexism, but he has also been accused of sexism. Kathy Aru, a reporter often invited on the network, accused Henry, Hannity, Carlson, and Kurtz of sexual harassment and gender discrimination. There you go. There you go.
I need to read more about exactly what Tucker
about your
was
guy?
Accused of doing.
About your guy?
Dude, honestly, if you told me that Tucker, like, had his kids via, like, artificial insemination, I'd believe it. I just don't think the Tuck Fox.
Here. Aru accused Hannity and Carlson of professional retaliation for refusing misogynistic behavior. Hannity offered $100 for a member of the staff to go on a date with her, which she described as a humiliating incident. That's a very low sum. She was hardly ever invited back on his show after she refused to play along, the suit said. Aru said Tucker Carlson implicitly invited her back to his hotel room for sex in 2018 and refused to have her on his show after she turned down his advances. There you go.
So sexual harassment is, hey, would you like to do something consenting? And she said no.
That's not the part, Michael. And goddamn you, I'm gonna fucking come through that glass right now and punch you in the face. Okay?
The part is that he didn't have her back on as a guest.
Yes, that is constantly used against women. That is a way that men constantly use to keep women behind. If you don't give me this sexual satisfaction that I'm asking for in the moment, you can't be on my show. You can't. You know the amount of times that's happened to me in comedy? It's fucking infuriating too, by people I used to like too. And I will fucking, I'll start naming names. I don't even give a shit. I don't even give a shit about
do
my career
it.
Anymore.
Do
no,
it.
No. But yes, that to me is the, like, one of the, like, slyest, stealthiest forms of sexism and sexual harassment that still exists. The butt hurt refusal to work with this person again. Yuck. Yuck, yuck, yuck. To me, it's like, That's even grosser than some more, like, rabid forms of sexual assault, in my opinion, because it's just so, you're such a fucking pussy-ass bitch. You're such a pussy-ass bitch if you do that. You got turned down and now you're not going to work with the person? Yuck. Ew. You suck. No one wants to fuck your crusty ass dick.
I mean, she had been featured on the show a handful of times between 2019 and 2020.
Yeah, you know, but you know, if she had gone in the hotel room and fucked him, she would have been featured a lot more prominently continuously. It's just, I mean,
so you're saying
this
that,
is a tale as old as fucking time.
As long as you have sex with a person, you cannot be the best guest and get invited back.
What?
I'm saying, like, you know, if she
continue crawling out of this hole, Michael.
There's no hole. Mm-hmm. I'm making the point that if, you know, this person comes on, she's an okay guest, the ratings are fine, mm-hmm. right? And you decide to go and sleep with this person, you're gonna keep getting invited back on. But if you decide not to, the guy can be like, "It's juice ain't worth the squeeze."
Nothing about what you just said is professional. Or should be used in a professional setting. So there's not anything I'm going to come back to. I mean, at what point in a professional setting are you using the saying, the juice is not worth the squeeze? Are we going to say, if you, why buy the cow if you're getting the milk for free next in a fucking professional setting, you psycho? Stop. You stop it right now, Michael Harrington.
She was also a liberal guest. Those people don't last long at Fox News.
Man, that just shows that the sex between a liberal and a Republican, fiery. Fiery. You know he wanted it so bad. These Republican boys love liberal chicks and vice versa. It's crazy. All right. So we're all up to date, guys. We got the information we need. That's the show. Send me any information that you can find about the whole Lady Gaga thing. I feel like you guys could find some TikToks or shit on that I'll watch in my free time. Thank you so much for joining us for another riveting episode of Without a Country. Thanks to Natalie and Mike in the booth. Appreciate you guys. Make sure to follow us on Instagram, Without a Country Podcast. Also subscribe to the Without a Country Podcast YouTube channel. These are coming out everywhere on Wednesdays now. Is that correct, Mike? It's been changing a lot. I need confirmation.
Yeah, so they're going to come out Tuesday midnight, and on... I am all messed up. Wednesdays into Thursdays on your Spotify, iTunes, wherever you find podcasts there.
Okay.
And on YouTube at let me just give an exact time. One second.
Yeah, because it's good when me, the host of the show, I go, I don't even really know when the show comes out anymore.
Wednesday, let's do 9 p.m.
Okay.
Wednesday, 9 p.m.
We're deciding now. Wednesday, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time is now when this show hits YouTube, so you can get the news faster. This is good. It's all, you know, it's when you're doing podcasting, and the most important thing is consistency. It's good that no one on the show has any clue when the show comes out. But again, thank you so much for watching this show. If you want to send me information, tips, stories, domestic violence, Lady Gaga, whatever it is, it's withoutacountrypodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much. Appreciate you. Have a great week. Bye.